planes. But he didn't know how to make a teleportation motor, and all efforts to work it out failed. Those blasted cyclomathematics. Nothing ever balanced. The thought made him restless. The bear had caught another fish. The sunlight played over Johnny's buckskin shirt. He had been sure something nice would happen today. Well, the day wasn't over. He touched Windsplitter's shoulder, and the horse decided it was a signal to run, which it wasn't, and went tearing up the trail for home. 2. They burst out of the forest and rushed toward the palace, and then Windsplitter made a huge show of how hard it was to stop. It wasn't, and reared and pawed the air. Show off, Johnny accused him. It hadn't been all that much of a run, only half a mile, but Windsplitter was content. The row that was going on in the middle of the 10-acre lawn attracted him. Stormy, the lame Blodgett's colt, he looked just like Windsplitter, even with his much too long legs, and a huge tan dog that had recently trotted out of the forest and adopted Chrissy were romping and plunging and racing away and pretending to stomp and bite, always missing. Blodgett was looking on without much concern, and Windsplitter walked over to her. Johnny slid off and raised his hand to the Russian in the control turret, hidden in the right-hand tower. A flick of a white sleeve as the guard waved back. This place had really changed. The only trouble with it was, it looked too new and shiny, and it certainly now would never age. The Chinese engineers had understood, but the Chatavarians just couldn't grasp that a place should show a little age. Johnny remembered when Chrissy had first spotted the place. They were in a small plane, and Johnny, having just bought the duchy, was trying to get some idea of its layout. Chrissy had all of a sudden leaned out the window and shouted, "There! There! There!" And nothing would do but that he land and let her look at the place. She had still been gaunt, and he couldn't refuse her much. The building had stood in the middle of a wilderness that might have once been parks. Hard to tell. Hard to tell even that the piled ruin of stone had ever been much but rocks. Chrissy had raced around, heedless of the briars that plucked at her buckskin leggings, shouting back at him in wild excitement. She pointed to a 50-acre plot, crying, "And that's just the place for a cattle yard!" And to another place, "Ideal for your horses!" And spreading her arms, indicating some pits, "Perfect for tanning vats!" And then tracing a stream that was bubbling along, minding its own business, "And this can be diverted to run right by the kitchen door, and we can have running water all the time." She had gone tearing around on the cracked remains of what might have been room floors, and pointed to outlines Johnny could not see. "A fireplace here, and one here, and another there." Then she had stood in front of him and said, "Here we will never be hungry. We will never be snowed in. We will never be cold." And then, defiantly, as though he might say no, "This is where we are going to live." Johnny got the Chatavarian chief engineer who had arrived with the 200 Chatavarian first construction contingent and told him to build something modern on the site. He thought he was rid of the problem, but the following day he found himself confronted by a very irate Chatavarian architectural team. When the Chatavarian became incensed, he sort of whistled through his teeth, quite distinct from the gurgling sound, like air coming up through a water bottle, when they laughed. The leading architect was whistling his indignation. It didn't matter whether Johnny owned the company, but Johnny was really a Chatavarian, proven by the fact that he had his title direct from the Empress Beaz. And he had to be told that he should know better. Completely at sea, Johnny was treated to a dissertation on architecture. They had studied earth forms, and many were all right. Classic Greek and Roman were known in other systems, and if impractical, were still acceptable. Gothic, neo-Gothic, and Renaissance architecture, they actually thought quite novel. They could even strain their artistic sensibilities by going along with Baroque. But modern? They quit. Send them back to Chatavaria. Send them back even though they would starve there. Some things one just couldn't do. It was only then that Johnny found that modern had been a type of architecture prevalent on Earth about 1,100 years ago, that it consisted of plain, straight up and down walls on a rectangular base, that it often was a vast expanse of glass windows, that it had been conceived by somebody dedicated to stamping out all indigenous architecture of an area. In short, modern was an architecture that wasn't architecture, but just a cheap way to throw rubbish in the air and get paid for it. The Chatavarian, with a quivering, pointing finger in the direction of the old city of Luxembourg, and backed up by the serious nods of five assistants, wailed that that whole town had been built in modern, and on his artistic soul no such abominations would be perpetuated while he lived. Johnny had apologized. The Chatavarian said maybe it came from having to talk in cyclo, and Johnny asked what they recommended. Five assistants presented a huge plan instantly. This building, they said, had been the palace of the Grand Duke of Luxembourg in ancient times, and even though Johnny did not think so, he didn't say so. The indigenous architecture, from the castles that lay about, probably had been Gothic and Neo-Gothic, and this palace should be like this. Johnny had delayed long enough to ask Chrissy, but all she gave him were the items she had found that made the place charming, and he had made sure those were included and had told them to go ahead. Chrissy and he had camped out in the woods, happy to be away from the din, cheerful in a buckskin tent, and eating good food cooked on an open fire. The Chatavarians had cleared the site and erected an armor steel shell. They had then flown down to a couple of marble quarries north of Leghorn in Italy, and operated a ferry of ore freighters until they had piles of green and rose and other colored slabs. They had spliced them together into an exterior and interior of polished, armored rock. They had underplated the stream so that it did what it was supposed to do. But they had also installed full plumbing. The fireplaces would burn wood, but since this was a waste of good food, they also put solar-driven infra-heaters in them and a simulated flame. It was a palace, all right, and it might be Gothic, but it sure was colorful. Chrissy had been enthralled with it. Johnny, as he walked to the arches on the other side of the drawbridge, could hear in the distance the crash and bang of the Chatavarians ripping the old city of Luxembourg into chips. They had gone through it with historical and artifact survey teams, and then the rams had been turned loose. That was the one piece of modern that would not survive. The bank had already moved back to Zurich, and Johnny would have liked to live there, too, because of the nearby mountains. Johnny halted. Dries Glotten must have been here today, for there was a burn spot in the lawn. Dries, after turning over his sector branch office, had been appointed Galactic Bank liaison with the Earth Planetary Bank. He had been the finder of the One, but a bank executive couldn't accept such rewards. They would undermine customer confidence. And Voraz had raised Dries' salary to 100,000 credits a year, quite enough to maintain his yacht and anything else. Dries had left the yacht here and teleported home, and while he was gone, his Salachi crew had been teaching the Chatavarians gambling games and winning a lot of their pay. But the Chinese engineers had been winning it back from the Salachis, so Johnny had kept out of it. Dries rambled all over in his yacht, an oddity to use a spacecraft to go to the corner store for a bottle of schnapps. But that was Dries. He had taken the job on the condition that he would have long weekends, and he seemed to always be going to northern Scotland. He said he was starting a peppermint industry on the side, but Johnny didn't believe him. He was sure something else was involved. Today he had probably brought Chrissy some butter or something. On the other hand, he might have been settling some accounts with Mr. Tsung. Dries kept certain customers, and Mr. Tsung was one of them. Johnny's account was cared for by 15 Salachis who worked down at the mine site, and Dries had nothing to do with that. It ran about $1 trillion a day income now, and was growing. Mr. Tsung's account was, however, somehow interesting to Dries. Johnny had offered Mr. Tsung a salary, and Mr. Tsung had been very surprised, for he said a chamberlain usually paid his boss, from which Johnny got the explanation of how some guests were always invited and some weren't. But it was Mr. Tsung's daughter that was making money. She was named Lu, after the last empress of the Han Dynasty, and she was becoming famous. She worked in a little pagoda-like structure out back that was really a disguised anti-aircraft pit, and she turned out pictures of tigers in the snow and birds flying and things like that on both silk and rice paper. And they were collector's items, bringing in 1,000 credits at a crack. She also worked around the house and helped Chrissy and cut hair. Johnny decided he'd better have a metal pad installed for Dries to land on. He got along fine with him now. No use to tell him off. He couldn't get through the courtyard. Lin Li, Mr. Tsung's son-in-law, had all the banquet hall furniture out and was working it over with molecular metal spray. The young man had an audience of a couple of awed Chataverians. He could paint pictures freehand with a metal spray gun and a piece of cardboard to catch the splatters. He was very quick. Right now, he was doing a scene Johnny knew he must have gotten from pictures of tapestries. A lot of nights. He was putting it on the huge banquet tabletop. He had stopped doing dragon medallions by hand. As they were all the same, a couple of Chataverian mechanics, awed by his ability, had gotten him to do a perfect one, and then had made a machine to turn them out at about 10,000 an hour. The demand out in the universe was such that they were backordered even so. Johnny couldn't get through without interrupting Lin Li. So he stood there watching. Chrissy and Mr. Tsung had been talking about the possibility of some of these Chataverians getting out of hand at a party and eating up the furniture. That must be what this metal plating was all about. They had to suit the dwelling to the many guests they always had. The vague feeling of disappointment hit him again. He had been certain, when he rose, that this was a sort of special day, that something wonderful was going to happen. It hadn't. Lin Li had just started on a ferocious figure of a charging knight. He was using a scarlet metal, putting blood on a blade. It made Johnny think of the red ink coming in so far on the Chataverian company Desperation Defense. If he could just unravel motors, he could put them over into passenger transport. But he was condemned if he would continue with reaction engines. Lin Li was guiding the molecular spray, now gray, to make the armor. The Chataverians were looking on with awe. One of them was holding a spare gun, ready to hand it to Lin Li. They weren't assistants. They just wished they could do things like that. The Chataverian closed the trigger of the gun to test it. Suddenly, Johnny knew it had happened. The nice thing. He sped back out the arch and raced all around the palace side and jumped the creek and popped into the back door. Chrissy, hair tied back, was filling a big bowl held by Mr. Tsung from a pot on the fire. "Chrissy," said Johnny, "get your things." Patty was sitting over in the corner. Patty never said anything these days. She just looked down. Tinny, the Buddhist communicator, had been trying to talk to her, as she often did. "Tinny," said Johnny, "call the mine site. Get me a marine attack plane on the pad in 20 minutes. Call Dr. McKendrick in Aberdeen and tell him to come right away to Victoria."
"Patty doesn't feel well," said Chrissy.
"Bring her along," said Johnny.
"Is it a diplomatic conference or a scientific one?" said Mr. Tsung, monotone through the vocoder.
"Medical," said Johnny. Mr. Tsung put down the bowl and raced off to put a white coat and a pair of spectacles, which had no glass in them, in a sack. That was proper dress he had seen in ancient pictures.
"Johnny," said Chrissy, "this is venison stew."
"We'll eat it on the plane. We're headed for Africa." 3. Johnny headed the marine attack plane slightly east of south and turned on his view screens. This co-pilot was new, from the French refugees in the Alps, named Pierre Solon. He was quite young, recently trained. He still had a little trouble speaking Cyclo. Usually, his duties consisted of simply shifting the mineside planes about, but as compound duty pilot, it had been up to him to deliver the ship to Johnny's house. He had not dreamed that in the next few minutes he would be flying co-pilot to the Tyler and heading for Africa. He had started out all right, but when he saw how Johnny took off, he had become overawed. He had never seen a plane lofted that way, like firing a bullet. And now they were flying hypersonic at only 15,000 feet. Would they clear the French and Italian Alps?
"We are awfully low," he timidly offered.
"People in back," said Johnny. Can't let them get too cold. Get to work with those view screens so we won't be running into any drones. Drones, drones, drones. All his life, Johnny had been being looked at by drones. It was no exception now. The Chatavarian defense system was only half complete. Despite buying the company, it was an expensive system, almost 3 times as costly as the one the small gray men had described, but it was about 10 times as good. Automatic blast cannon that fired 1,500 miles into space could shoot down a space fleet with one salvo. Atmosphere drones that fired. Space drones that patrolled orbits. Probes that scanned anything moving within 10 light-years. Real armor cable that would make every city untouchable. As the system was incomplete, a lot of emergency stand-in drones were about, and they were attracted to anything flying. A huge green flashing light was going on top of the plane, and the box there, newly installed, was sending out the code of the day, which was so fast and so scrambled and changing microsecond to microsecond that an attacker could not hope to duplicate it. If the drones didn't see and hear it, they'd shoot. Ah, yes, here came the Mediterranean emergency drones, 3 of them, shooting over to have a look. The co-pilot was slow, and Johnny tuned a knob to focus them. Chatavarian drones, all right. Each one had a big eye painted on its nose. But those big, staring eyes were not a Chatavarian fixation on decoration. A pilot would instinctively shoot into the center of them, and if a pilot did, the drone used the shot as a return carrier wave to send a surge back that blew up the attacker's own ammunition and thereby his ship. Don't shoot at one of those eyes. Nevertheless, they were a bit disconcerting, glaring out of the view screen. They nudged in like sniffing dogs, and then, satisfied by automatically cross-verifying with each other, they fell away and returned to their patrol sectors. The French pilot was looking back at the Alps. They hadn't hit any. But Johnny had his screens on the orbit drones now. They seemed to be disinterested, satisfied by the code of the day. And what was this? He had a space probe on the screen. He hadn't known you could see one. Was it hostile? Like any star drone or probe, these things had a lens that was made of a light magnet. This reacted on light beams and pulled them in from a zone many miles in diameter and concentrated them, magnetically corrected for aberration, into a spot smaller than a dot on paper. In effect, it made a lens many, many miles in diameter. The problem was too much light rather than too little, and they had blinders or filters that dropped into place to keep them from burning out their receivers or recording discs should they turn toward a sun too close. In that way, one could get magnifications into the tens of trillions. One of the contractors had drilled Johnny in on command controls, and a box of these existed overhead. Johnny flipped a switch and tapped the probe's receiver and shifted the image to his own central view screen. It was their own space probe, all right. He was looking at the co-pilot and himself behind their own view screen. Yet that space probe was over 10,000 miles away. It must be at the near end of a run. Friendly, so he threw the tap off. He didn't really think anybody would attack Earth now. The peace treaty had gone in, as promised, with claws. Very, very popular. The delegates had even taken home copies of the end of Cyclo and the death of Asart. The bank was shoveling out food loans like a waterfall. Consumer products had not yet begun to roll. That would take time. He hoped he could get at the secret of how one built a teleportation motor. That would open the door to a lot of consumer products. And even more important, keep the vehicles they had here operating. These planes wouldn't last forever. Take over, he told the French pilot, Pierre, and went back into the body of the plane. Chrissy stirred herself and unwrapped a bowl.
I'm afraid the venison stew might be cold now.
Johnny sat down in one of the huge bucket seats. Patty was down at the back of the plane, just sitting there, looking down. It worried him. Sometimes she went for walks at night. Sometimes he could hear her in her room crying. Because she was only 10, he had thought she would recover, but she hadn't. Mr. Tsung, he saw, was going to use this time-space to catch up with his diplomatic and social duties. For here he came with about 10 pounds of paper. Johnny put his attention on the stew. It wasn't cold.
"This week's dispatch box came in from Snouch," he said.
So that was what Dries was doing coming down from Zurich. Send the business matters down to the mineside office. It's their job.
"Oh, I did, said Mr. Tsung. "These are all social and diplomatic. Invitations to weddings, banquets, christenings, requests to address meetings."
"Well, thank them and tell them no," said Johnny.
"Oh, I have, said Mr. Tsung. "We don't have any trouble. We use a vocal reader, a vocoder, and a vocotyper. We can handle correspondence in about 18,000 languages now, but this is going to get heavier."
Here it comes, thought Johnny. Mr. Tsung's elder brother had been appointed chamberlain to the court of the chief of Clan Fergus. His younger brother was busy starting up a diplomatic college in Edinburgh. "You got another brother?" said Johnny, around a mouthful of stew.
"I am sorry that I don't," retorted Mr. Tsung. "I'm talking about the nephew of Baron von Roth. He wants to apprentice as a diplomat in my office."
"Fine," said Johnny. Mr. Tsung adjusted the vocoder volume higher as the plane was roaring more with Pierre at the console.
"I want to hire about 30 more Russian and Chinese girls to train as clerks and vocotyper operators. It's really very simple. One reads invitations with a vocoreader into one's own language, and then one uses a vocoder to talk to the vocotyper, and it types the answer back into the tongue of the original letter."
"Go ahead," said Johnny.
"I think there should be a new building to take care of all these people and files. Something more on a Chinese..."
"Go ahead," said Johnny.
"There was one letter that I pulled out that you should see," said Mr. Tsung. "It's from Lord Voraz to MacAdam with a copy to you, and Dries said MacAdam had to hear from you before he answered."
Trouble, thought Johnny.
"Voraz wants a formula to determine the validity of a commercial loan."
"That's not diplomatic or social," said Johnny.
"It's kind of diplomatic," said Mr. Tsung. "Voraz and MacAdam being who they are, one does not wish to see tensions. The whole problem is what consumer products should arms companies convert to. If they convert to the wrong ones, the whole program will fail, and the bank will have granted useless loans."
His own problem in a different dress, thought Johnny. He thought of the red ink of desperation defense.
"Intergalactic Mining," said Mr. Tsung, looking at the Voraz letter, "was sitting on hundreds of thousands of inventions that were on file in the Hall of Legality to prevent other nations from using them. I know this isn't diplomatic, but it could make a big diplomatic mess if the bank lends money to make the wrong products. Also, all the invention formulas are in Cyclomath."
Johnny had finished the venison stew, and he gave the bowl back to Chrissy. There was something in the old man books about this. What was the subject? Marketing is a factor in profit. "You tell MacAdam to have banks get out survey teams, people that go around and ask people questions, and find out what people in each planetary area think they would want to buy. Not what they should buy, but what they want to buy. Don't offer suggestions. Just ask them. For all they know, it might be as little as a..." He recalled his own discovery that glass would cut. "As something to skin hides more easily. The subject is marketing surveys. And I'm working on Cyclomath right now." Tinny had been listening. She was already punching phone buttons. This was a new system. But it was kind of overdone. The smallest exchange the Chatavarians made for a planet had 2 billion individual radio channels. And since the war, they only had about 31,000 people. There were radio phone printers everywhere. She was on to the Zurich bank, plugging in the recording she had just made of his voice. Tsung saw Johnny wasn't going to say more, and nodded to her, and she let it start. The printed reply would be rolling off onto MacAdam's desk right now. She fed in the reference letter Tsung gave her.
Dry's left you this, said Mr. Tsung.
He handed Johnny a little blue disc with a pin on the back of it. It said Galactic Bank on the front of it. When he saw Johnny looking at it, but not taking it, he added,
The Chatoverian Deadly Device Officer passed it.
Johnny took it. He give you anything else?
Oh, you know Dries, said Mr. Tsung. He said there was an excess supply of butter up in the highlands now, and he brought Chrissy a whole bucket of it. Some old woman has 15 Holstein cows, and he says he's financing a butter business.
Johnny laughed. There had been no Holstein cows in Scotland that he knew of. Dries must have persuaded a pilot to fly them up from Germany or Switzerland, where they roamed wild. Another peppermint industry. Do we give him anything in return?
Oh, yes, said Mr. Tsung. We always feed him a tub of fried rice. He loves it. And my son-in-law found a book of colored plates of fish, and he made up some fish medallions, and we give him one of those each time. He says they are valuable.
And you pay Lin Li, said Johnny, wise to the ways of commerce and the Chinese.
Of course, from your social petty cash.
The term petty cash could be pretty general. The Earth Planetary Bank was paying for Earth's defense system out of petty cash. But Mr. Tsung was going on.
That button is a pre-run of prizes they are giving out in their new neighborhood bank program all through the universes. You know, to people who open up accounts. It will in each case be in the local language. You put it on your collar tab or a place like that, and then you hum a note, and as long as you move your mouth, the button will sing. They are gathering up all the folk songs of each local region.
Johnny got a kit out of his bag. He had brought it to help the project he was on right now. He took a micro-annealer and opened the button up and looked at its insides with a micro-viewer. It was just a molecular-sized set of storage cells with little triggers and relays. A tiny battery charged itself from room heat. An electron-vibrating prong set atmosphere molecules in motion to make sound. Simple. Rather cheap. But that wasn't what Johnny was looking for. He often suspected the bank acquired information in peculiar ways, and he checked vocoders and such like to make sure they didn't contain a radio mic or a recording thread that could be taken back later. He had never found one so far, but that was the world he now lived in. He micro-annealed it back together and hung it on his buckskin collar.
That isn't a standard one, he said to tell you.
Piped Mr. Tsung through his own monotone vocoder.
He collected some old records of American ballads and put them in it. There aren't very many Americans, so it won't be manufactured for them.
Johnny cleared his throat and moved his mouth. The button hummed a wordless tune. Hadn't he heard that tune before? Scottish? German? Ah, it was called Jingle Bells. Then the button sang,
Galactic Bank, my friend so tried and true. Oh, what fun it is to have a neighbor such as you.
And then, in a proud voice, it said,
I am a customer of the Galactic Bank.
Well, that certainly wasn't any American ballad. Was Dries having a joke? He never joked, really. A very serious, small gray man. Johnny was about to take it off, but his laugh started it up again.
Home, home on the range, where the deer and the buffalo play.
Johnny remembered you had to keep moving your jaws to make it sing. Saliva pops or muscle tension or something. He started moving his jaws again.
Where there seldom is heard a discouraging word.
Mr. Tyler,
came through the intercom from the nervous Pierre.
I can see Lake Victoria on the view screens through the overcast. It's totally clouded in ahead. Hadn't I better go on to Kariba?
Johnny went forward and took over the console. It was always overcast at Victoria. Johnny opened his mouth to call in for clearance, but the button sang,
And the skies are not cloudy all day.
What a lousy forecast. thought Johnny, and put the button in his pocket. 4. After glancing over the flying conditions, Johnny could not much blame Pierre. For a while now, they had been flying through the night, a fact which an experienced instrument pilot would not have thought about twice, and indeed, Johnny had scarcely noticed it. By looking very hard, and only then with trained pilot's eyes, one could just barely make out Mount Elgon rising above the black cloud carpet, for there was no moon, and such a peak became mainly visible because it blocked out certain stars. It was the screens which caused Johnny to forgive Pierre. So thick was the cloud layer below them that the view screens aimed at it were more snowstorm than image. You would actually have to know the shape of the lake and the compound to have any notion of what you were looking at. A lot of electrostatic disturbance. It must be raining like fury at the compound, rain flicked with lightning. Pierre, however, was in a state of mind that wasn't asking for anything but to stand on solid ground. He could not read the screens. He could not see anything but some stars above them and blackness below them, a blackness lashed now and then by some internal flash. He thought they were done for if they tried to go down through that. Who knew what hill they would run into? He would have been petrified had he known that Mount Elgon was higher than they were flying, but mercifully he did not know that. Nor, even more frightening, that they had passed by a couple of peaks even higher. Magnifying his alarm, Monsieur Tyler had come back to the pilot seat and hummed a strange song. Mon Dieu! One did not sing when one faced certain death. Lunacy! Victoria gave them permission to land, and Johnny felt his way down through the rain clouds. His screens didn't clear up, but knowing the area, he could identify the scraps of image he sometimes glimpsed. It was useless to look through the screen. It looked like it had a fire hose being played on it. Johnny felt for the ground with his skids, more concerned about a bump affecting his passengers than about where he was. He did it very smoothly, and Pierre was again alarmed when Johnny turned off the motors. He thought they were still in the air. The rain was actually making it hard to talk in the cab of the plane. Johnny threw open the door, and there was Care standing there, water cascading off him in the plane lights. Even allowing for the deluge, Care was awfully glum-looking. He was usually very glad to see Johnny. The last time Johnny had been in Africa, he and Care had spent 3 nights working the Kariba rig. The planet Phobia had been very elusive. They had no coordinates for it beyond somewhere around the Cyclo Sun, and for a while it had seemed they would never discover it, and Care would eventually die from having no breathe gas. The planet was, however, located. It was doing a squashed ellipse. Phobia's perihelion, the point in its orbit where it was nearest its sun, was so much closer to its sun than its aphelion, the point in its orbit where it was furthest, and the distance to its sun from these 2 points was so vastly different, near and far, that anyone trying to live on Phobia would have perished, even a cyclo. Phobia went through 3 states. As it swung away from its sun, its atmosphere chilled and became liquid. As its distance increased, the liquid froze to solidity. As it again approached its sun, the sequence reversed and the atmosphere became gaseous again. But this long period of having a summer, and the Phobia year was about 83 of Earth's, permitted moss and other plants to grow, and these flourished for a time and then, as the atmosphere liquefied, remained in a state of suspended animation until summer came again. Although they had an awful time with camera triangulation to estimate its orbit, the end product had been beyond Care's wildest dreams. The planet was well into autumn, and it was no real trick to pump huge cable tanks full of liquid breathe gas. Not only that, but they had brought back about 50 tons of the material needed to make real goo food. Yes, Care had been acting like a cyclo gone to heaven, a most unlikely event, when Johnny and he had last met. And here he stood, glum in the rain.
"Hello, Johnny," he said woodenly.
"What's the matter with you?" said Johnny. "Lost your loaded dice?"
"Oh, it's not you, Johnny. I'm always glad to see you. It's that Maz. He was chief engineer here when the place was operating. One of the wounded ones. I got about 70 ex-prisoners from all over, and I'm trying to earn my pay by getting this tungsten mine going again.
He moved nearer, the rain cascading down his breathe gas mask, his tunic sodden with the hot rain that battered him.
I'm no engineer, he suddenly wailed. I was an operations officer. We ran out of ore body, and the next one is just beyond it someplace. That blank Maz and all those other blank cyclos just sit down there on their butts in gloom. Some blank fool showed them the pictures of cyclo blowing up, and they just won't do anything. I don't know any blank math, and I can't calculate the next ore deposits.
That's two of us, thought Johnny. He was glad the girls didn't speak cyclo. The ex-underworld midget could really swear, but he almost never did unless he was terribly upset. That's why I'm here, he said.
Really?
Care brightened up like a mind charge had gone off in him. Has McKendrick arrived? Said Johnny.
Control got a drone report on a plane from Scotland. That McKendrick? He'd be about 3 hours behind you.
3 hours? Johnny had wanted to get to work right away. Well, there was something else he had to do first anyway. Get some cyclo corpses. There's people in the back. Do me a favor and get them into the compound.
Right,
said Care, cheered up. He had a folded mine tarp on his arm he could use on the others as a rain shield. He sloshed toward the rear door, unfolding it. Pierre had been recovering, but now he was horrified to find that Johnny was rummaging around in a locker for high-altitude suits. Johnny threw one at him and began to pull on another one. Johnny heard the door slam in back and saw dim figures running toward the compound in the rain. He finished zipping up his suit and checked his fuel. Plenty. 20 seconds later, they were hurtling into the sky again. Pierre was still struggling into the unfamiliar high-altitude suit.
Mon Dieu! Life around Monsieur Tyler was hair-raising.
Johnny was unperturbed about it all. Up above the rain clouds, the screens were clean, and by seeing what stars were omitted, he could even eyeball the peaks. He left the plane lights on, heading for the glacial snows where they had left the cyclo corpses. He needed two, he thought. A workman and an executive. It did not help Pierre's frame of mind at all not to be told where they were going, nor why. Charging into the ink at such speeds appalled him. He did not even look at the view screens. His eyes were riveted through the now-streaked windscreen. Very shortly, Johnny was in the right location. He knew they had left a forklift up here. He would use that to guide in. He supposed that after all this time, the corpses would be pretty well covered with snow. But Pierre, not knowing what was being looked for or where or why, simply looked through the windscreen, his eyes dilated with something that was getting up close to terror. Suddenly, Pierre saw a whiteness. It had puffs blowing off it in the plane lights. With horror, he heard the engines wind down for a landing.
Don't! He screamed. Don't! Don't! You're landing on a cloud!
Johnny glanced up through the view screen. It did look like a cloud at that, seen from this angle. A high wind was blowing snow about. Ah, there was the forklift, up to its seat in snow and ice. The corpses would be lying, covered up, just beyond it. He had been flying by screens only. They were a long way from the nearest drop-off. He let the ship crunch down into the snow and shut off the motors. The wind was screaming up here, enough to make the plane tremble. Johnny settled his air mask on tighter. Get out and give me a hand. Pierre was in total confusion. He had clearly seen them land on a cloud, and he could not understand what was holding the ship up. He knew, from their earlier course, that they must be close to, if not on, the Earth's equator, and recent studies had told him that the equator was very hot, so snow was the furthest thing from his imagination. His small tribe had been under the domination of Jesuit priests, and they had controlled, by instilling a heavy fear of heaven and hell, mostly the latter. The reputation of Monsieur Tyler was itself a matter of growing superstition and awe. It surprised him less that they had landed on a cloud than it did to be told to get out. Pierre looked at the puffs of white in the ship's light. Yes, a cloud. He fingered the image of a crucified Christ that hung about his neck. He felt he was too young to be a martyr. But there was a solution. He snatched the jet backpack from the compartment behind the seat and hastily shrugged into it. Monsieur Tyler quite probably was able to walk on clouds, but that didn't include Madame Solon's son, Pierre. It took a lot of courage to open the door, but he did so. He closed his eyes tightly and sprang out, hand on the backpack firing trigger. It was about 8 feet down from a seat of such a plane to the ground, but Pierre had been nerved up to fall 12,000. When he hit the ground, despite snow, he almost broke his legs. Pierre fell backward in total confusion and lay propped on his elbows in the snow. He could not understand why he had not fallen through the cloud. Johnny, intent on his project, was oblivious of all this confusion. He had taken a mine crowbar from the plane's toolkit and was prospecting through the snow for the corpses. They certainly were covered up. The tip of the iron bar found one. He knelt and brushed away some snow, the particles flying away in the wind. He uncovered the tip of a breathe gas mask and then the ornament of a cap. Yep, an executive. He felt around under the monstrous shoulders to see where he had to insert the flat end of the crowbar to pry the monster loose from the adhesions of ice. One of these cyclos weighed about 1,000 pounds, more in all this snow and ice. Johnny inserted the crowbar deeper and heaved down on it. The monster was so stuck that the top end of the bar slipped and tore open his high-altitude jacket fastenings. He tried again, this time giving it all the strength he had. With a creaking, low-pitched sound, the monster moved upward. But the sound must have been close to that of clearing one's throat. The bank's singing button in his pocket gave out a ballad line with a baritone voice.
Ghost riders in the sky.
Pierre, already badly shaken, beheld a demon rising from out of the cloud. And not only that, it was singing in a sepulchral voice. It was a lot too much. With a low moan, he fainted dead away. 5. Johnny loosened the workman's corpse with the bar and then went to the forklift and knocked ice out of its cogs and ratchets. He was about to start it up when he noticed the absence of Pierre. He had expected him to open the loading doors of the plane, at least. He spotted the man lying in a shadow made by a balance motor. The snow was already blowing over him. A bit anxiously, he checked to see if he was injured, puzzled by the presence of the jet backpack, wondering why he was lying there unconscious. Well, this was no place for even first aid. Johnny got the forklift moving and scooped up Pierre. He ran the machine down the length of the ship to the doors and, standing on the seat, got them open. But the wind, coming from the tail of the plane, was trying to bang the door closed. Johnny jumped up to the fuselage flooring in hopes of finding something to block the door and stopped in his tracks. Patty. She was still in the plane. They must have overlooked her in their scramble to get through the rain. She made so little sound and motion these days, she easily went unnoticed. She must be freezing. Johnny opened an equipment locker and dragged out a blanket and threw it around her. She hardly even looked up. All he could find to block the door open was the stick from a map roller, and he tried to make it do by butting it against a floor equipment ring and pushing it against a hinge. He got down and operated the forklift to boost the inert body of Pierre into the plane. He had almost made it when a powerful gust of wind banged the door shut. Once more he climbed into the plane to try to make the stick prop the door, but this time the frail wood splintered. A soft voice sounded behind him.
I will hold it open for you.
Patty, gripping the blanket to her with one hand, put the other on the door and braced it open. This was the first time he had seen her volunteer anything for months. Johnny jumped down onto the forklift and raised Pierre up and dumped him on the floor plates. He got into the plane once more and began tugging the man over to the side out of the way, and was a bit amazed to see Patty pulling on the body to help. So, with Patty to hold the door open, Johnny was able to fork the two monstrous bodies out of the snow and dump them into the plane. Patty was watching him, and what he was doing, intently. Shortly, he parked the forklift, closed up the plane, and got into the cab out of the cutting wind. He phoned the compound to have a flatbed and forklift waiting, and then, checking to see if Patty was strapped in, shot the plane up into the sky. He had been prepared to feel his way down through the overcast with half-blind screens, and was very happy to see that the worst of the storm and all of its electrical interference had passed by. It was no longer raining at the compound, and they had every pole spotlight on. Quite a crowd had gathered around the waiting vehicles to see the plane come in. The last time Johnny had seen some of these ex-Marines and ex-spacemen had been through gun sights, and it was a trifle strange beholding Jambit Chows and Hawvins and such standing around, but they seemed inoffensive enough. Three Chatoverian engineers in bright orange work suits that had Desperation Defense written on their chests were in the crowd, probably there doing preparatory surveys to convert this mine site protection over to the new system. A new plane was there with nobody around it, and Johnny realized that McKendrick must have arrived. He called Patty forward, and with her under one arm, jumped down from the plane. Care was sitting on a forklift. "The co-pilot is in there. He's breathing, but he must be injured or something," said Johnny. "Get him and the two cyclos down to the hospital." Johnny, still carrying Patty, rushed into the compound to find McKendrick. Care promptly got busy with the forklift and, with an expertise only Care could achieve with a machine, scooped all three bodies off the floor of the Marine attack plane and swooshed them over to the flatbed. The driver, a newly trained Jambit Chow, looked on in wide-eyed shock as he saw two huge cyclo bodies plump down on the truck with a small human body dropping on top of them. The first impulse of the crowd seeing cyclos was to retreat, and fast. All the snow and ice had melted off them, and to all appearances they might be alive. The driver was about to get off the truck and put distance between himself and anything that had to do with cyclos that might suddenly come to life. Care withdrew the forks and realized he was in the middle of a commotion and was about to have no driver.
"No, no," he shouted. "They're dead."
Timidly, the Jambit Chow got back on the flatbed seat. Cautiously, the crowd crept forward to get a closer look. Eyes went questioningly to Care.
"Didn't you hear what Johnny told me?"
said Care. No, they hadn't, too far away.
"Those cyclos," said Care, "have been hiding out in the jungle. They rushed out of cover and started to claw the co-pilot to bits, and it made Johnny so mad he charged them. He grabbed the throats of both of them at the same time and just plain strangled them to death."
Mouths were open and eyes were popped. The evidence was right there before them. After a moment, a Hawvin ex-officer said,
"No wonder we lost this war."
"Yes," said Care. "When you get to know Johnny better, you'll realize that when he gets mad, he gets mad."
He signaled the flatbed to follow and drove off in the forklift. He just couldn't resist doing what he'd done. But the hardest part was to keep from guffawing in their faces. 6. Johnny, when he got into the compound, put Patty down and went looking for McKendrick. He found him in the hospital.
"Where's the epidemic?" demanded McKendrick. "I got your call in the middle of a medical lecture. I brought a whole medical team. And when I get here, I find you've taken off."
"This time," said Johnny, "we're going to do it."
"Oh," said McKendrick.
"You mean the capsules. Johnny, I've tried every way I can think of, and there is no getting in those skulls. Too much bone. I thought I showed you."
The doctor went over to where he'd last left the huge cyclo skull. He knocked his knuckles on it.
"It's just plain, solid bone. The brain is clear down under the lower back plate. If I drill out enough bone to get to it, you'll just have a dead cyclo."
"Ah," said Johnny. "You used the word drill. I didn't." He walked over to the skull and picked it up, all 50 pounds of it. McKendrick had wired on the joints, and Johnny opened the jaw. Now, watch the ear bones. He got a better grip and held it up to the light, an action something like juggling a medicine ball. Watch. He opened the jaw again. The hinge, not the place a cyclo heard through, but the place where the ear bone met the back jawline, opened to show a hole about a 32nd of an inch in diameter. You showed me this once, said Johnny, and explained you couldn't get an instrument through it, but it leads right to the spots where the capsules are embedded in the brain. McKendrick was skeptical.
Johnny, I got a whole team in there cleaning the place up for a possible operation. I thought something serious had occurred. But as it's no emergency, why don't we just get some sleep?
Johnny took the skull over to the table they had used before for dissection and put it down. It may look like no emergency to you, but the truth is that we don't know how to make a cyclo motor, and we don't know how to work their math. If we don't know these things, we could come unstuck. We must have hundreds of planes right this minute that are inoperative. We need consumer products out in the planets, and the cyclo motors are tops. It's an emergency that'll do for now. But watch. Johnny took a thin insulated wire from his pocket and inserted it in the tiny skull hole. He took the other end of the wire and pushed it through the tiny hole on the other side.
What are you doing? Demanded McKendrick.
Now the question you must answer is, will these wires pushed in tear up any jaw or ear muscles?
Oh, they might hit some tissue, but the main muscles aren't there. That hole occurs because the jawbone, when extended to the extreme lower position, would have to leave a hole. Otherwise, there would have to be two additional bone plates, and Lord knows there's enough already. I don't think...
Johnny reached for the kit he had hastily packed. He drew out a molecular plating gun. This thing pours a stream of molecules from a rod onto a surface. McKendrick was at sea.
You can't get a gun like that in a head.
The gun unit goes outside. He dug out an electrical terminal plate. Where is one of those capsules we removed? McKendrick got one of the two half circles of bronze. Johnny snipped off some lengths of insulated wire. He took the molecular plating gun and connected a length to the electrode that ordinarily fed current to the rod of spray metal. Then he laid the other end on the bit of bronze. He took a second piece of wire and laid it from the bronze to the electrical terminal plate. Then he connected the back of the terminal plate with a long wire to the current input terminal of the gun. He was simply going to substitute the bit of bronze for the gun's usual spray rod and then bypass the spraying component, but instead make the molecules flow on a wire to a receiving plate. And just to make sure electrolysis would occur, he was completing the circuit back to the gun. He pressed the trigger. The terminal plate began to be plated in bronze. A tiny hole appeared in the capsule taken from a cyclo head. No electrician, McKendrick said,
"It's disappearing."
"We're flowing the metal molecules up the wire to the plate. I think it's called electrolysis. We're just not letting the metal molecules spray. We're flowing them onto a plate." He adjusted the wires to the bit of bronze so that an inflow hit a different spot and the outflow occurred from a new place. McKendrick gawped.
"That piece of metal is disappearing."
"It's reappearing over on the terminal plate," said Johnny, "but that will be outside the head." He picked up a new bit of wire and with a small torch melted the end of it round. "If we take the sharp point off, can you wiggle this wire in through that hinge hole, around the various nerves and touch the bronze bit in the skull? And then do the same thing from the other side?" This was something McKendrick knew about. The corded nerves of a cyclo brain were easy to push around. The cortex, or covering of the brain, could probably be pierced in a couple of tiny places without much damage.
"We'll see," said McKendrick, giving up all thought of waiting for morning.
The cyclo bodies were lying on two mine carts outside the door. Pierre seemed to have vanished. McKendrick called in two nurses and another doctor, and they wheeled the workman's cyclo into the dissection room. It was about five times as much body as they were used to handling, but with everyone helping, they got it on a table. It's probably still frozen inside, said Johnny.
No problem, said McKendrick. You forgot? We've been through this before. A couple of times, I was all hopeful we could even operate.
He took a stack of microwave emanating pads and plopped them on either side of the head to thaw it out with a quick defreeze. The room seemed awfully populated. Mr. Tsung was giving Johnny a white coat and a pair of lensless glasses. Johnny wondered what they were for and put them in his pocket. He was about to order a repositioning of the body when the singing button started up. It sang,
Gone are the days when my heart was young and gay. Gone are the days.
The medical team was startled and a bit shocked. The scene was macabre enough without somebody singing a doleful dirge. Johnny pushed the button at Mr. Tsung. Get rid of this thing. Pulling other bits out of his kit, Johnny got to work making a more easily handled setup. Dr. McKendrick was getting the metal analyzer they used for an X-ray machine in place. He put the head of the corpse on it and tuned the dials so that he had a sharp, clean picture of the bronze capsule. He was testing the jaws of the corpse to see if they were flexible and, finding they were, propped them open with a metal expansion tool. The other doctor was mopping up water that had run off the cadaver's head and was getting the lower wave emanation plate wet. A nurse leaned over to Johnny and whispered,
I don't think this little girl should be in here during all this.
Johnny turned, and there was Patty. She must have followed him in. She was looking with interest at the bleached skull. This was the first day in all these months he had seen Patty noticing her environment. He was not going to suppress her by telling her to get out. Let her stay, he whispered to the nurse. The woman was a bit disapproving, but she did not push it. Johnny had his rig ready. McKendrick was looking at some sketches he had made of cyclobrain nerves. He laid the drawings down, took the offered wires, and got to work. Watching the viewplate and checking the sketches, he began to work a blunted wire end in. He finally, with a few minor detours, got it to the embedded bronze. Then he got the other wire through to the other side of the metal. Johnny verified they were ready and threw the switch. The exterior terminal plate began to turn bronze. McKendrick worked very delicately, feeding in electricity to one side of the plate and taking it from the other. It was, looking at the viewplate, sort of like cleaning up a blot. The bronze in the skull became less and less. McKendrick steered the wires around. After about half an hour, he could find no further shadows or traces of the bronze in the skull. He carefully withdrew the wires.
Now to see if we burned nerves, he said.
The team went into immediate action. They broke out aprons and gloves and a set of instruments, including a spinning disc bone saw. The nurse leaned over to Johnny again and whispered,
I do really think that little girl ought to go. This is too much for anyone that young. How old is she? 10?
Patty was sitting on a stool, overlooking the proceedings. She was very interested. Nothing could have made Johnny banish her.
Leave her alone, he whispered back.
They removed the viewers and put down pans and cloths. And in a moment, the bone saw was whining and screeching into the skull. Shortly, green blood began to flow, and the team mopped it up. McKendrick had done this so often that it seemed only minutes before they were looking at the place where the bronze had been. McKendrick mopped up a bit more blood and got out a glass and inspected the nerves.
The tiniest amount of burn, he said.
I'll reduce the amperage, said Johnny. He got busy installing a rheostat in the circuit. The team was throwing the bits of the dead cyclo back together. They heaved him off the table and back onto the minecart and shoved him out in the hall. 2 minutes later, they had the former executive on the table. They repeated the molecular flow operation on the bronze and got rid of it. Johnny did a test on a silver capsule they already had from times past. McKendrick consulted his drawings again. The doctor pulled the wires back and fished them in again on the silver capsule in the cadaver's brain. It went along all right until they got to the fuse in it. It was so tiny and so quickly melted that it took quite some time to pick up all the bits. The wires, manipulated around, were more likely to touch each other than the scraps left. Eventually, that was gone too.